Okay, so I'd like to read the koan out today, and this is koan is from our koan picker. So as I mentioned last time, Raf developed this new system whereby it just picks a koan, you know, and that's it. So the koan picker has picked this particular koan, and it's from Shoyoroko. Shoyoroko Book of Equanimity, which is usually the one, two, three, the fourth book of koans that we deal with. So let me just read it out. Introduction. People use jewels from Mount Kai to strike down magpies. Old rats bite pieces of gold. They don't understand their treasure. They can't make use of it. Is there anyone who suddenly finds the gem hidden in their own clothes? The case. Shiso asked Nansen, people do not recognize the money pearl. It is intimately grasped in the treasury of the Tathagata. What is this treasury? Nansen said, old master O exchanges questions and answers with you. That's it. Shiso said, how about when there is no exchange of questions and answers? Nansen said, that's also the treasury. Shiso said, what is the pearl? Nansen called him to come near, saying, Shiso. Shiso said, yes. Nansen said, get out. You don't understand my words. The verse. Differentiating yes and no, clarifying gain and loss. Responding to this in the heart, pointing to that in the palm. Coming and going. Not coming and not going. Both are nothing but the treasury. King Tenrin rewarded the worthy ones with it. Emperor Yellow found it through a blind man. Turning the pivotal activities skilled in the art. You clear-eyed monks never take it ceaselessly. So first reading of this, you might think, what a doozy again, you know, what is this? So let's unpack it. That's what we do. We unpack a koan here at the Teisho. So we're looking at it from various perspectives. So unpacking this koan. First of all, Book of Equanimity is a collection of sayings from various masters to students, and each koan is a representation of that particular saying. It was compiled in the 12th century by Master Wenchi. By Master Wenchi. He also wrote the verse to it. So he collected, so he didn't write the koans, he just collected them as sayings. It's like someone here heard, you know, a teacher talk to a student and they recorded that saying, if you like. And they became known as koan or cases or precedents, if you like. Precedence to what? Precedence to awakening. It's always about the koan is always about the absolute world. Okay. So he collected those koans in the 12th century and formulated them into a collection, and then he wrote a verse. And the verse is like an appreciation of it. So a verse always relates to the koan. And then 100 years later, Master Bansho wrote the introduction. You know, and sometimes the introduction and the verse gives us a lot of insight. And sometimes the verse is also made into a koan. So that's how it works. So for those that are new here, I'd just like to give you that brief introduction. So let's get started. So the introduction says, so keep in mind the introduction is by Master Bansho. And it's always good to also remember that this was written in the year 1200. So this is, you know, Middle Ages China. So it's a completely different worldview to ours, and keep that in mind. People use jewels from Mount Kai to strike down magpies. Okay, so Mount Kai, you could probably say, in those days was like the Argyle mine in the Kimberley. People used diamonds, pink diamonds, you know, or opals from Lightning Ridge. You know, or Cooper Pedy, you know, or pink diamonds, the most precious jewel that you can imagine, to strike down magpies. So So here the image is that the only time you would do that, pick up a stone and throw it at a magpie, or throw it at anything, or maybe flip it over a river to see it go, is if you would not know the value of it. If you know the value of it, you wouldn't do it. So that's what this refers to. There's a jewel there, and people use it carelessly. They don't know what they've got. So that's what he's referring to right here. So the jewel here, keep in mind this is a koan. So the first question to ask is, what's the jewel? The jewel and this koan is always about our true self. So this refers to our true self. The jewel refers to our true self. So keep that in mind. So people use it to throw at magpies. Children would do that too. You know, children don't care. They don't really, they don't know the value like, you know, we adults have different value system than children would. A stone is a stone and a diamond is a diamond. There's no difference to a child or a magpie for that matter. Old rats bite pieces of gold. They chew away on pieces of gold, you know. Today we might say geckos chew on wiring on the air conditioning. They don't know that it's cost $3,000 to fix it. They just, it's a wire, and they just keep on nibbling away at this wire, and they just, old geckos or geckos chip away at the wire at the air conditioning. Or as in my case, in my car. You know, cost me $15,000, thank you very much. So those rats, you know, those damn rats, you know. So again, same thing. The value is arbitrary, you know, very much arbitrary. Now comes the next line. They don't understand their treasure. They can't make use of it. I didn't ask, but I presume you guys on Zoom can hear me. Yeah, it's all good, yeah. Okay, they don't understand their treasure. They can't make use of it. And it's a little bit like us. We don't understand the treasure of our true self. And of course, if we don't understand it, we can't make use of it. But also, some of us might understand it. They might have seen it, but they still don't know how to use it. So I just want to spend a little bit of time on those two aspects. You know, it's very important. They don't understand their treasure and they can't make use of it. So first of all, to understand the treasure, we need to realize it. We need to realize the value, or we need to realize actually what it is. Otherwise, we, like a child looking at a pink diamond or a magpie looking at a pink diamond, we just go along. Before you know it, life's done. We're dead. We haven't understood anything. Okay. So the first aspect is understanding it. How can we understand it if we don't know it? That's another good question. How can we understand it? How can a child know what it is if it doesn't realize the value of it? So this is quite important, because how do we get to that point of actually seeing our true self? And, you know, of course, in Buddhism, as in other traditions, this is dependent upon conditions. Certain conditions need to be present for us to be able to see it. Okay. Now, it's like, why do we come and sit? Why do we come and meditate? Again, based on conditions. And those conditions vary from person to person. So we might, for instance, have a condition of someone dying, or an accident. We might be affected by from a life and death situation, and we might all that may completely change our value system. We might be going along smoothly, all of a sudden our loved one dies, a child dies, a parent dies, a partner dies. That may change our value system. It needs something to trigger it, in other words. You know, and we might not, and it might be different triggers for different people. It might be someone saying something, like we heard it quite often in different other koans, where even a sound can trigger it. You know, so there needs to be somehow a trigger system for us to go, oh, and then our value system changes. Others may already have that value system because they've been taught that. They may have been brought up in a Buddhist tradition, or they may be brought up in a Christian tradition, or whatever, and they may already get a sense of that. You know, Classical Buddhism teaches that it's karma, meaning that it goes from life to life to life to life. Whether we believe in that or not is really doesn't really matter. That's another way of explaining it, I guess. So conditions need to be there. Famously, of course, the Buddha lived in a, by all accounts from the stories, he lived in a very prosperous family. You know, in a ruling family even. And the story goes that he was triggered to become a renunciant, a homeless person, if you like, by choice, when he saw an old person. He didn't understand what he'd never seen an old person. He was shielded from this. A sick person. He then saw a sick person. He never understood until that time saw what a sick person is. There's a whole story about it. You can do have a whole koan on this particular story. Then he saw a dead person. I don't know if some of you may not have seen a dead person. That certainly triggers something. I remember once traveling from Longreach, accident, there's a dead person on the road here, traveling along, and all of a sudden, bang, big reality check right there. That's a trigger of all of a sudden our value system is challenged, or our normal way of looking at things is challenged. And coming back to the Buddha, the other thing that triggered him was seeing a sage or a wanderer or an ascetic, you know, that actually was on the quest to discovering what the true self was. And after those triggers, he made a decision to become an ascetic and to find out what it is. He was no longer happy with his existing life, even though it was a life of comfort by all accounts and a life of control by all accounts. But that was his trigger point, okay? So they don't understand the treasure. So the Buddha in those days, you could say, did not understand his own treasure, but there was something there that made him realize, wow, I wanna find out what this is. And I think most of us that are here, whether pre-Kensho or post-Kensho, we wanna keep going on this. We are keeping going on this quest because we wanna find out more. We wanna see what is beyond all of this. You know, and this goes beyond religion or religious traditions. Every religious tradition has this quest. It's just formulated differently, in different words, through different stories and different concepts, different symbols. But ultimately, it's the same quest, the same quest. Now, when we are getting to the point of being triggered, and most of us here would already have had some sort of a trigger to say, okay, I want to go and meditate. I want to go and sit facing the wall. I mean, what a ridiculous thing to do. I want to do this. I want to keep going. We already must have had some sort of a trigger. And you could call that trigger a desire, or we can call that an intention. Okay. Now, this is quite interesting because, as you all know, I hope, having listened to the introductory lectures, that ultimately the aim is to get rid of intention completely, because intention is still triggered by self. Of course, the whole process is letting go of self, you know. So how can you do that? You know, we need an intention not to have an intention. That needs to be first an intention not to have an intention, you know. So that trips quite a few people up, this notion. But what is actually taught in the classical canon is that there are different degrees of intentions or different degrees of desire. You know, we all know the Four Noble Truths, I hope. And the Four Noble Truths was of course Buddha's formulation of his realization where life is suffering. You know, there's an arising of suffering, and of course we know the cause of suffering is desire, intention, if you like. And there's a cessation of suffering, you know, which is when we let go of it. Letting go of intention means letting go of self. As soon as we let go of intention, we let go of suffering. Another word for that is nirvana, at a very, very, very refined point, you know. And there's a path to that cessation, meaning the Eightfold Noble Path. Coming back to that now, coming back to that original part of desire, okay, it's a little bit like when I was looking at this, I was reminded of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So Maslow was a very famous psychologist, transpersonal psychologist, in the 60s, and he established that, you know, that we, our motivation is based on needs. So if we have a motivation, if we have a motivation of, say, sitting in meditation, but certain needs aren't met, there is no way we would go and sit in meditation. In other words, if I'm hungry and I haven't got a shelter and I haven't got security, I'm not going to go and join a meditation group. I'm going to make sure I'm going to have some food, and I'm going to make sure that I'm going to have a roof over my head. So these are basic needs that need to be met in order to, and we move up those, we move up a rank of needs in order to get to where we are at. That includes material possessions, that no matter where that is in our cycle, in our lifestyle. And it's the same thing with desire and intention. So if you like, the most basic form of desire, or the way it is taught in Buddhism anyway, is actually a harmful. Buddhism calls it wholesome and unwholesome. So one of the most basic unwholesome desires that we first need to let go of is greed, hatred, illusion. These are the that's the first rung, if you like. If we're stuck in greed and in hatred, then we cannot get to the most elevated forms of desire or the most elevated forms of intentions. Okay. So they're the first ones to let go of. So that would be someone that is maybe even an addict. You know, there's all sorts of forms of greed. There might be material greed, or there might be bodily greed, like where we are addicted to substances. It might be drugs, you know, alcohol, smoking, it might be gambling. You know, it might just be sheer greed, as in wanting to get richer and richer and richer and richer. You know, so that's sort of the first, and then this is what Buddhism is classified as an unwholesome desire. So, like, imagine going up a ladder. So we go up that ladder, and we've now come to a point. But again, for that desire, or that intention for us to let go of that, you know, certain conditions need to be there, you know. And that's why we can have compassion for those that are not at that level yet, you know. There is, again, it's needs-based. There is certain people have certain needs, like you take drugs, for instance. They might have such an unwholesome state of mind that the only way that they can have some peace is if they take drugs. They have a joint. They can relax, or alcohol. You know, I don't know if you read The Little Prince by Saint-Exupéry. There's a lovely story there about, why do you drink? So I forget that I'm a drunk. You know, it's like that. You know, we get trapped in our own head with certain, you know, with certain conditions. It's really hard to get rid of those. So the message here is that, you know, again, certain conditions need to be met in order to move up, you know, up the rank of, if you like, of desire. So if we manage to get past those unwholesome desires, then come the more wholesome desires. And the most basic wholesome desire is, of course, food and shelter. You know, we can't, without food and shelter, you know, coming back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, again, it's unlikely we will go to the more elevated levels of desire or elevated levels of intentions. So after that might come the refined desires. This gets tricky now. So we might have food and we might have shelter, but I like soy milk in my coffee, thank you very much. Or, you know, I don't like this and I like that. So this is, all of a sudden now we are looking at designer clothes versus basic clothes. There's another form of desire, but it's more refined. So we've got to keep watching it, where it is, you know, in many ways. By the way, there's nothing right or wrong with all of this, but it's interesting to observe. If we let go of that desire, in other words, I don't really care if I want, you know, it doesn't mean that we get rid of it in the sense that we don't have any preferences anymore. But if we don't get our preferences, it's not a big deal. Sorry, there's no soy milk left. We ran out. Are we going to have a hissy fit? You know, can we live with this? You know, it's like that. Like, so our mode changes as in, okay, that's just the desire I have. It's really interesting working with this. Working with our desires is working with renunciation. Especially in a lay context. I mean, monastics are really hardcore training on this. But from a lay perspective, when I catch myself, you know, like I'm quite often, I don't eat in the morning because I like this little fasting period. And I know some of you are on that as well. So I don't eat until, say, 12 o'clock. And quite often I have this desire, you know, to have a piece of toast in the morning. Now, the awareness, if I don't have awareness, I just go and eat it. Oh, stuff it, I'm going to have it now. You know, the desire takes over. If I have awareness, I can look at that desire and I can say, isn't that interesting? And I can watch what is actually happening mentally and I can watch what's happening in my body. You know, the craving part in the body and the mental argumentation, it's like someone is telling me, oh no, you can do it. There's this story going on that is arguing for one thing and there's this other side that says, nah, don't have it. It's really interesting to watch this, you know. But it's, if I'm aware of it, I can let go of it. If I'm not aware of it. And so working with it strengthens that part in us that can actually manipulate, if you like, our own story in our head, you know, to let go of things. And you know, we teach this in prison to some degree, and it's really interesting, you know. And of course, we've got to ask ourselves every time when we fall into an unwholesome aspect of desire, you know, especially if we are aware of it. Then we can look at it and we can make a decision that brings us out of it. The next part from the refined part of desire, according to Buddhism, this is in various sutras, not explained the way the Buddha explained it in a much nicer way than I do. But there's another way of looking at a different desire is the next level is a very, very wholesome desire, and that is a desire to be ethically engaged, to become a good human being, to be of service. That is still a desire. We still have desire. We still have, if you like, if an intention to do that. Okay. So that's what would be called, and you know, even the intention to sit is an elevated, if you like, desire. And then the last one, which is categorized as awakening. You know, as awakening is when we can let completely go of that, even of the desire to sit, because we don't need it anymore. It just, life just happens on their own, and it happens on its own. And this there's a word in the Pali canon called samviga, samviga. And samviga is a word that means that once we reach a certain point on that ladder, you know, an urgency takes place. And by the way, that doesn't mean we can't go fall back down the ladder occasionally. And I mean, it gets all it's not completely, you know, on an upward scale, if you like. Sometimes we fall back and we come back, and there's all these. It's a little bit dynamic, just looking at it from my own experience. But there comes an urgency all of a sudden called samviga when we are at a certain point where we can no longer go backwards. In Buddhism also, that's called stream entry, where it doesn't matter what happens, we just have to go along that journey. It's out of our control. And the reason it's out of our control is because we're no longer fighting. We are no longer fighting our desire. We are no longer at the bottom rank fighting, you know. It's like we let go to, no, another way of looking at it is it's a process of letting go. We let go to such a degree that it's all happening. I don't have to do anything. You know, I don't have to do anything to come here and sit. I don't have to have any desire to come here and sit. I just turn up. But even that just happens. You know, the alarm clock goes, oh, the next thing, oh, look at what am I going to talk about today. The next thing happens, I'm here, I'm talking, you know. There's actually desire and all of that, it doesn't even come into it anymore. That's how it works. And when we say, you know, you really got to let go of it. Let go of it, of your desire to awaken, you know. That will happen. That it just happens after a while because it happens anyway. You just don't think it happens. It happens actually anyway. It's just that we don't see it. You know, it's a natural process that eventually takes place. But there are these trigger points. So okay, that comes up. Once realized. Okay, sorry. We were at this first one, which at the previous one, which was number three. Where is it? Number two. They don't understand their treasure. So that's where we were at. They don't understand their treasure. They don't understand their real self. So how to get there? To understand it. Understanding it is understanding the treasure. And then the next thing is once we realize the treasure. Once we see it, and there are different degrees of seeing it, we might see it intellectually. We might see it experientially. In other words, we have an experience of seeing it. That is when we have a moment of clarity, when all of a sudden there's the big bang moment or a little bang moment, whichever way you want to look at it. We call that a Kensho experience, an awakening experience. Okay, so there's different degrees of seeing it. But usually it starts with just a purely intellectual, I can see that intellectually, but we really still haven't tasted it. We've looked at the menu, if you like, but we haven't tasted the food yet, you know. So once we get a glimpse of tasting it, even then, there's degrees of tasting it, you know. There's absolute, we might have just taken a little morsel of it. Instead of eating the whole plate, you know, there's degrees here, you know. And then we can't make use of it in daily life, meaning we can't. It's not yet personalized. So this comes back to the three aims in Zen, you know. First of all, to sit, you know, we're starting on the journey. Then to have that experience, the Kensho experience, and then to personalize that experience. I like to call it personalizing Buddhism. We are personalizing all these teachings, you know. We don't need to know the teachings, by the way, because the teachings will be what we, the way we live. That is the teaching. It's our life. It's the teaching, you know. We can use, of course, the teachings as a model, as a guide, and also as a barometer to see whether we're on the right track or not. You know, that works as well. So once realized that we can make use of it in our daily life, again, awareness is crucial to recognize it. And I'd like to give you an example again. When we're suffering, it doesn't matter what degree of suffering it is, when we're suffering, it usually relates to some form of desire. I mean, that is what the Buddha taught, that the cause of suffering is desire. Okay. So next time you're suffering, it means there is a desire there. Check that out. Just check that out. What is it? At that moment of suffering, what am I clinging to? And that'll give you a clue. And at that moment, if you can let go of that clinging, suffering is gone. Just like that. And, you know, it's like, and it's usually, it's because we're clinging to something in the past or the future. Right now, there cannot be any clinging. Otherwise, the clinging is always relates to something in the future or in the past. You know, I want this. I didn't get this. It's always about something. Why do you talk to me like that? It's already passed. Someone just called me whatever name. It's already gone. I want it to be different than the way it is. There's always something that causes my suffering that is always related to some form of desire. You know, please remember that next time you've got a tricky situation or you get triggered in some sort, it's about that. It's about that. There's some form of not letting go. It goes actually much deeper than that. I remember once at a Kenshukai is a teacher's training, where the Roshi, this is the Japanese Roshi, he said, "I'm already dead." You know, and this was quite a few years ago. And at the time, I thought, "Oh, what a statement! I'm already dead. What does that mean? I'm already dead." You know. And then, not long ago, I read a book. And there was a quote by Ajahn Chah, which I like very much. Ajahn Chah is a Theravadan monk in the Thai forest tradition. And he said in this quote, the cup is already broken. So he had a cup and he said, the cup is already broken. And I just got it. I just got this, you know, I understood that term that the Roshi used, I'm already dead, completely differently. I'm already dead, you know. So if I say this glass is already broken, this glass is already broken, what does that mean? You know, actually the word already, to my way of thinking, doesn't nail it. The glass is always broken. I'm always dead. What that means is that the concept of glass is like, what is this? This is nothing but broken material. This glass is broken, meaning in order to make glass, you have to have sand. So someone used sand, and I guess they took it from a beach. So they broke the beach. Then they put it into something, and they formed something. And all of a sudden, this sand and whatever other minerals, whatever constitute glass, is nothing but brokenness of something else. Something was broken to make this glass. Something was broken to make me and you. You know, when my mom and dad got together, you know, and made children, what are they made out of? Broken oranges and cows and meat and veggies. Everything is always broken, always. There is nothing that is whole. Can you see the liberation in seeing that? The liberation that, can you see that? That's the message of impermanence. That's impermanence. You know, everything is impermanent. It means everything is broken, everything is dead and alive. Because there's a glass made alive. It's dead and alive at the same time. That's the message of impermanence. And it is so liberating. You've got to see that. You know. You've got to see that. And coming back to this, they don't know, how does it go, how to make use of it in our daily life. Well, I tell you what, if you can see that in the midst of your problem, that's how to make use of it. If you have a problem and you see the reality the way it is, which is another word for Dharma, if you see the Dharma, meaning the way it is, if you see everything broken already, the release is a release from suffering, instant. doesn't matter what the suffering is. You know, I get out of my head space into my heart space. And there it is. So this, they don't know how to make use of it. I just wanted to touch on that. Okay, number three. So by the way, the more we engage like that, and of course koan work, as you know, is like that. Koan works, this is a koan. We're working, koan gets us to that, somehow pushes us, if you like, to get into, to maintain those states of mind. And the more we do that, that's why we do it on a weekly basis, not just occasionally. The more we engage with koans like that, the more we are continuously, at the beginning, intentionally focusing on this state of mind, trying to get in there, trying to see that until it becomes an effortless state. And then eventually we see it. You know. Okay, next line. Is there anyone who suddenly finds the gem hidden in their own clothes? So it asks us here, is there anyone who can see the gem, the jewel, our true self, hidden in their clothes? This relates to a Chinese story where there's a rich man and a poor man and they're good friends. And they sit on a bench and they get drunk. And they get so drunk that the poor man, unfortunately, he falls over and he falls asleep. And the rich man, he's also drunk. He thinks, oh, I've got to help this guy. But he still hasn't gone that far that he's so drunk that he can't get up anymore. And he's got a really precious jewel. And he sews it into the poor man's clothing. He sews it in there, okay? And then he leaves. And so the story goes, as it happens, they don't see each other due to all sorts of circumstances for many, many years. And after many, many years, the rich man's got richer and the poor man's got poorer. And he sees the poor man again. And they embrace, because they're friends. And he says, didn't you find the jewel? I put it in your coat. It's right there in your coat. And this, so the moral of the story is he was poor and at the same time in his head, always poor, but he was super rich because he had this pink diamond in his coat. And it's like that with our true self. Our true self is always there. We are super rich. You know, we are fully enlightened as it is already. It is, we just can't see it. You know, and there are, of course, the degrees of seeing it, you know. But, and this is the message in Mahayana Buddhism, it is complete as it is already. There is nothing to get. It's just a matter of getting rid of, not getting more. Just need to let go, let go, let go is the message. You know, that's the message of this story. It's a lovely story on that. Okay, now we come to the case. So this was just the introduction. The case is very simple. Okay, it won't take long. Okay, so Shiso asked Nansen, people do not recognize the many pearl. It is intimately grasped in the treasury of the Tathagata. This phrase comes from Shudoka. At Sesshin, we always recite the Shudoka. So that's his question. People do not recognize the many jewel. You guys now would recognize it, of course, you know, having just heard about all of this. So people do not recognize the many jewel. It is intimately grasped in the treasury of the Tathagata. So the treasury of the Buddha's teaching, or the storehouse consciousness. There are many ways you can many ways we can interpret that last part, but we won't go into it. In other words, again, that's the question he asked Nansen. Nansen was his teacher, you know, famous Nansen. People do not recognize the jewel. They do not recognize themselves, you know. It is intimately grasped in the treasury. Tathagata is, in other words, for Buddha or Buddhism or awakening. It is intimately grasped in the treasury of awakening, is another way of saying. And then he asks, what is this treasure? Oh, that's a good question. What is this treasure? Straightforward. Please give me a plain answer. If nothing else, then gives plain answers. Okay. Here you're going to get an answer. Nansen said, old master. Oh, now O means Nansen. Okay, so Nansen refers to himself. He says, old master Nansen exchanges questions and answers with you. That's it, he says. Shisu said, how about when there is no exchange of questions and answers? I get that all the time in Dokusan. But how about, how about, there's always a how about, or why not, and here and there. And but how about when there is no exchange of questions and answers? Nansen said, that's also the treasury. That's also it, you know. Then Shisu said, hang on a second. Then what is the pearl? You know, what's the pearl? And Nansen called over and says, Shisu, Greg, Sue, you know, Bodhi. He said, Shisu said, yes. He said, get out of here. You don't understand my words. He chucked them out. That's the case. Okay, let's go to the verse. The verse by Wanchi. The verse by Wanchi. Differentiating yes and no. Clarifying gain and loss. Clarifying, and I like that word. That's what we do in Koan work. We clarify self. We clarify true self. That's what this Koan work is all about. We are clarifying our own delusions. Get rid of them through clarification. Okay, again, not intellectually. Obviously, as you know, we're doing it in a different way. So differentiating yes and no. Differentiating yes and no, which is differentiating is the world of duality that keeps us trapped. Differentiating yes and no, why, here, there's always another. Doesn't matter what you find in that world of logic, that world of differentiation, there's always a yes or a no, or a here or a there, or a rich or a poor. Differentiating yes or no, clarifying loss and gain, rich and poor. You know, clarifying clarification is what this is about. Clarifying means that you don't take sides. There is no yes and no. There is no poor and rich. We do not take sides. That's clarifying. But of course, as he said, but actually there is no such thing. You know, clarifying yes and no is to see that. It's one and the same. It's another way of looking at it. Yes and no is one and the same thing. Rich and poor is one and the same thing. That's what it means, clarifying what actually clarifying is. You know, it's not to take sides. The degree to which I can clarify this is to which the degree to which suffering stops. Simple as that. If I can get to a moment of seeing it, at that moment it's gone. Well, no matter what suffering I have, it's gone. That's very, very great, great line. Differentiating yes and no, clarifying gain and loss. Responding to this in the heart, pointing to that in the palm. Again, responding to it in the heart. In other words, this is a contemplative exercise. Responding to it is like, I've got to respond to that from that vision of no yes and no. Responding to any situation from this clarity, you know. From the heart, pointing to that in the palm. When I read this, I was reminded of William Blake's famous poem, to see a world a grain of sand, to see a world in a grain of sand, and the heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. That seamlessness, there's no gap, that seamlessness. You know. There is no gap between the universe and this glass. Everything is broken. Everything is brokenness. Everything is dead. Everything is alive, whatever word you want to use. coming and going, it goes on. Not coming, not going. Both are nothing but a treasury. Coming and going. I mean, how often do we get trapped on that? If I go this way, then Jack might say, oh, he's coming. Then I go this way, and then someone is outside, oh, Arno is coming now. Which one is it? Coming, is it going this way or is it that way? It depends on how we... But where am I... So if I turn around now, am I now going? You can determine whether I'm coming or I'm going. But actually, all I'm doing is walking. All I'm doing is walking, and we call that coming and going. And we get caught up in this, like we do in so many other things. You know, try harder. Well, how can I try? I do. There's just doing. There's no such thing as trying. It's impossible to try. Either I lift it or I don't. In between, even lifting, not lifting. These are concepts we are so blind, that we're so blinded by these concepts that we can't see the way it is. You know, this is what this refers to. King Tenrin rewarded the worthy ones with it. So this refers to the king that, you know, he rewarded his warriors, you know, with a jewel. And it's like here, I guess the inference is that if we practice, we get rewarded. You know, if on this way we get rewarded, what do we get rewarded with? Awakening, seeing it in a certain way. So this is how this relates to. Emperor Yellow found it through a blind man. Emperor Yellow found it, meaning the treasure, through a blind man. Again, here's a story about Emperor Yellow who lost his jewel on a beach. And so, of course, it was a very precious jewel. The emperor would not have anything other but a precious jewel. So he sent his wisest person to look for it. Oh, no, I couldn't find it. Could not. Mr. Wise Man could not find this jewel. Then he sent his orator, the best orator he had, to look for it. Oh, the orator couldn't, Mr. Orator or Mrs. Orator couldn't find it either. Then he sent his top administrator. Administrator went out looking. No, couldn't find it. Could not find it. Mr. and Mrs. Administrator could not find the jewel. Then he sent out his servant to go and have a look for the jewel. Mr. and Mrs. Servant couldn't find the jewel either. So finally he decided, I sent the blind guy. You know? And of course the blind person got it. Okay. So here is an interesting story. Blind, as in the conventional way of looking at it. We need to be blind to it. We need to let go of it. Once we are blind to yes and no and rich and poor, once we are blind of that world of differentiating, it appears. So that's why we, you know, if we start looking for it, as I always say, you know, if you start looking for mu, you start looking for it, it's impossible to find because there's a you and there's something to look for. You know, that's what makes it impossible to find. You need to be totally blind in order to find it, you know. So this is what this refers to. So the last two lines, turning the pivotal activities skilled in the art. By the way, you know, there's so many different ways to interpret these things. So it's what you get out of it, of course, that makes it important. So the way to look at turning the pivotal activity, to me, the pivotal activity is that moment of awareness. That moment of awareness where I can see that glass is broken. If I can see that, that's a pivotal, that moment, that's an art form. That's what he's referring to. Turning the pivotal activity. So it doesn't matter what activity it is. You know, it's a state of mind. If I can see that, you know, it changes everything. It changes everything. It changes literally everything. You clear-eyed monks never take it seriously. So you clear-eyed students never take it carelessly, I should say, carelessly. Work towards it, practice, keep on sitting.